of the country. Speak for yourself and ask your questions directly by calling Night Call in New York City from anywhere in North America. Here are Night Call special phone numbers. From the East and Midwest, call Collect at area code 212-749-3311. From the West at 212-749-4300. And from the New York area at 866-5010. Now from New York City, Night Call's host, Del Shields.
Good evening. It's kind of amazing if you stop and think for a moment. Civil service strikes are just as illegal today as they were back in 1919 when Calvin Coolidge said then, when he was governor of Massachusetts, there is no right to strike against the public safety by anybody, anywhere, anytime, unquote. And I say amazing since it is undoubtedly true that all the furies and the frustrations and fears of our decaying cities are part of the daily life of the civil servant. From the welfare worker to the garbage collector, the policeman who is spat upon and sometimes called a pig, the fireman who enters the fire-filled building to save another's life, how are these civil servants to respond if they cannot legally strike? When I read the newspapers, and from the opposite view, how are the rights and safety of the public to be protected if civil servants are free to strike at any time? It seems to me that the so-called public servants who happen to make up 1/6 of the American force, or the American workforce, are gaining the ear of a widening number of state officials throughout this country. Now, whether public strikes are to be made legal or not is another thing. But the fact still remains, how should the public employees of a city show their grievances? Tonight, my guest calling in from Memphis, Tennessee, is Reverend James Lawson, the Methodist minister who was one of the leaders in the famous Memphis garbage strike last year that brought the late Dr. King to Memphis. And Reverend Lawson, good evening, and thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you, Dale. It's good to be here.
How was the weather in Memphis?
Cold, well, like most of the rest of the nation, I guess.
Reverend Lawson, we'll begin our conversation tonight on Night Call by asking, should the public servants be able to strike?
Well, I think that, of course, we must recognize that the efforts to make strikes of public servants illegal has failed because public servant strikes in the United States have been on a steady increase. And so what I would suggest is that having the no-strike prohibition, trying to claim that public employees do not have the right to strike is of no value because they themselves, having legitimate grievances, are finding other ways to handle it. They can call in sick. They can slow down their operations. And furthermore, of course, it has to be recognized that it's helping to create chaos because particularly local and state governments do not want to try to provide ways by which there will be collective bargaining. The right of collective bargaining on the part of public employees will be guaranteed and ensured. And it seems to me that this is the real issue, that state and local governments are tending to try to say that there is a difference between a worker in the private sector and a worker in the public sector. And this effort, I think, is clearly today being repudiated by public workers themselves. So my point would be that the strike prohibition has been ineffectual, and that what we really need is the sanity of local and state governments in particular, recognizing the right of workers who work for them to organize and to bargain collectively.
Well, if there is no difference between a worker in the public sector or a worker in the private sector, as you call them, is there not a difference between the employer of the public sector as well as the employer of the private sector?
Well, only in the sense that the public employer may not want to deal with the issues as clearly because he always has his eye, perhaps, on the political issue, politi- expediency, whereas the private employer who owns the company or manages the company does have the power to sit down and deal with the question on purely what is best for his production line or what is best for his business.
Well, may I pose the question another way? You have the government is not in the business to make money. And then you have the private employee who is in the business to make a profit or to make money. Now, is there not a difference?
Perhaps in terms of the end of the employer, the purpose of the employer, but not certainly from the perspective of the right of the employee for decent jobs, living wages, benefits. From that perspective, I see no difference at all.
Well, the private employer can decide at any time to go out of business if that is an option for him. Of course, he cannot lock out the employees, but he can go out of business or he can seek some other redress. But there is no redress for the government. Is that true?
Oh, yes, there would be redress, and that is the redress of the government. It seems to me that the government, particularly local and state governments, because this is the great wilderness area, because I think we should say that the federal government tends increasingly, particularly since the 1962 executive order of President Kennedy, the federal government tends to increasingly recognize the collective bargaining right of employees, and therefore to try to provide means for this to occur. It's on the state and local level that we're having the real problems. Now, my thesis here would be that the employee still has certain fundamental rights. The fact that his employer is a city government does not deter from those rights. In fact, because the government is supposed to be the protector of the rights of all people, it seems to me it ought to be even more responsible for the rights of its employees than the private sector. Because after all, if the local government is not going to really protect the rights of those it hires and employs who are supposed to try to carry out the responsibilities of the government, then, you know, is that government really trustworthy in ensuring other rights for which it is responsible?
Well, is that actually the question, or is it that we have not succeeded in finding or setting up the proper kind of machinery to enable the government employees to address their grievances?
Well, I think in most instances in this area, we have not set up machinery to provide for collective bargaining for public employees. Now, here again, I'm speaking primarily in terms of state and municipal government. I think, if my memory serves me correctly, that less than half of the states of the Union have any kind of machinery that recognizes the right of collective bargaining. And some of the states that do have such legislation, that legislation is prohibitive legislation rather than creative legislation that is trying to provide meaningful channels for public employees to handle grievances and problems.
Now, what is to happen when, and I think possibly the most dramatic example would be the policemen and the firemen who are
right.
responsible for the safety of the people in the community
right.
and for upholding the law, when they openly defy and disobey a law that says that you are not to strike, and then under the disguise, like in New York, where the policemen suddenly
right.
discovered Hong Kong flu as a means of, or as an excuse to stay out in order to make their issue more dramatic. Are they right or are they wrong in their attempts to find some method of alerting the city governments to their needs?
Del, I feel as though our society here has a great deal of homework to do. Now, and let's see if I can answer that in a couple of ways. One, by trying to suggest that I feel that in a lot of ways In our country today, we want public employees to kind of be what you might call the nigger of our society, to do the dirty work that many of the rest of us do not want to do any longer. I think this is true for the policeman as an illustration. It's the policeman, for example, who must bear the brunt. He's called in to quell legitimate demonstrations. He's called in to see to it that students don't get out of hand. He's called in to repress black people, to do these kinds of tasks. Now, my own thesis is that this whole attitude concerning the public employee needs to be fundamentally changed. And that's the breaking point. Because, for example, if we want police officers who are going to be more aware of the complexities of law enforcement in our society, then certainly these men must not be frustrated because of things like salary, working conditions, promotions, and many other forms of grievances. You simply cannot afford it. So my own thought is here that initially, in order to have good government, you must have employees that are seen as persons with real dignity. Therefore, their rights to bargain and all must be firmly and thoroughly established, just as the rights of such employees are established in the private sector. Now, the second thing I would say is that there's a vast difference then also between the police officer and, let's say, the clerks in City Hall. Just as there's a difference, it seems to me, between the registered nurses in city hospitals and garbage men.
Is there a difference if both groups or if the three groups disobey the law?
Well, my own point at the problem of this law is my own thought is that a law which says that a group of employees do not have the right to demonstrate their grievances in peaceful ways, that law is really a bad law. It's unjust, it's unfair, if not unconstitutional. So that, here again, I think that if we want people to respect the law, law then must provide justice for people. And this kind of a injunction that some cities and states have taken into court, or this kind of a public act, a public ordinance, a law, it seems to me is a grossly unfair one. And of course, my whole thesis at that point is that you have two ways of changing it. You change it by taking it to court and following that long process, which of course many groups have done, or you also change it by simply ignoring it and making it irrelevant. And this is precisely, of course, a part of what's happening now in the vastly, in the great increase of strikes, that public employees just ignoring it.
But if there is a law that states that public employees are not to strike, and the public employees insist upon breaking this law, what effect does this have on the rest of us who are asked to, and sometimes requested and forced to obey laws that we may feel are not just laws?
Well, of course, Dale, as you well know, we're in a very difficult area because many of us in the whole civil rights struggle, as with the sanitation strike, have tried to differentiate between the just law, the fair law, and then those laws that have been imposed upon people only because they protect in some way a status quo that is itself unfair, unjust. Now, it's at... we're moving into this very difficult area. And my own thesis is that these laws, which are passed purely for the purpose of saying that public employees do not have the right of collective bargaining, these laws are going to be subjected to court tests, and they're going to be subjected to the break-in, to being broken on the part of public employees, who reach a point that their grievances are so unfair and are not being looked at honestly that they just move then into that ground of ignoring that no-strike law.
Reverend Lawson, I'm going to ask you to hold for just a moment. We're going to break for station identification, then we'll be coming back. I would like to pursue this, but I don't want to hold up our listeners. But I agree with your thesis that it is unfair for many of the public employees. But I'm also concerned about the effect of this, especially in a situation, if I can go back to a local situation here in New York, when the state police decided that they, not decided, but when they wanted an increase in salary, and they felt that the only way that they could effectively dramatize their request or their demand, they decided that they were going to step up the disbursements of tickets and summonses. Now, this to me, I interpret this as making a mockery of the law, because if you're going to give out summonses and tickets to motorists who are speeding, right, or to prohibit them or to restrain them and to hopefully persuade them to drive more carefully, and we only use this law as punishment in order to help them to gain their point, then I think that we are leaving a lot of us in a very terrible situation. So if you'll hold, we'll come right back to you. This is Night Call in New York. We'll return right after station identification.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Reverend James Lawson after station identification.
The year 2000 is a little more than a generation away. For our cities, the question is precisely this: will the new millennium mark a celebration or awake? If you think you can sit snug in a suburban split level while the cities slide downhill, you're only kidding yourself. Slums won't stop at the city line any more than commuters do. What happens to our cities happens to our suburbs. Together we can remake our cities. We will. We must. If you think there's nothing you can do to help, think harder.
Send for the free booklet, The Turning Point. Write Night Call, Pomona, New York. That's Night Call, Pomona, New York. Ask your own questions direct. Speak for yourself, collect from anywhere in North America to guest Reverend James Lawson, a leader of the Memphis garbage strike, about the problems and rights of public service workers. Call Night Call Collect from the East and Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. From the West on area code 212-749-4300. And from the New York area on 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
Our guest tonight is Reverend James Lawson, who speaks out for the rights of public service workers to strike. And to our Night Call listeners, how do you feel? Do you feel that public servants should be permitted the right to strike? We'd like to hear from you, so we'll take our first call tonight from New York. Miss White is hearing Night Call over WRVR-FM. Miss White?
Yes, good evening.
Good evening, ma'am. How are you?
Well, thank you. Now, I am a retired civil service employee. And I have, I was a union member, and until 3 years ago, I don't think there'd been a strike till the Department of Welfare workers went out. I did not go out because I don't approve of it. And the question I want to know is, I hear people saying civil service employees should have the right of collective bargaining. Is a strike equated with collective bargaining? I haven't been able to get that from even the co-workers, because I thought belonging to a union with a head representing you, that you were bargaining collectively.
Reverend Lawson?
Yes. Well, I think the point is here, that if a union doesn't have the right to strike, either when a contract runs out, you know, and the failure to create a new contract, then, in actual fact, the union has no real power, because its power is not simply in its membership, but its power is also in the ability of its membership to move away from the production line.
Yes, I know.
In order to pull the business to a halt. Now, so the whole point would be, now, if you found some way by which you could give another kind of power to the workers, then, of course, you would need the strike as a form of power. But at this point, at least at this point, to operate without the capacity or the ability to strike means then that you go into the bargaining table as an inferior member at that bargaining table and without real power.
Yes, well, I know for many years, through collective bargaining, many objectives were obtained without strike until...
Of course.
Within the city.
For example, I can name you some outstanding examples.
Striking against people, I can't see that. I don't know. I just don't see. I don't know where our power lies then. Actually, in a way, we're striking against ourselves.
May I just say, though, you see, that this is absolutely correct. You can make many gains at the bargaining table without striking. And, of course, in the United States still, most gains are made this way. But it is basically because you do have power when you sit at the bargaining table. And that power is your capacity to pull the working processes of the business or of the sanitation department or something to a halt.
It would seem to me now that the strike anyway isn't out of date. I mean, in the 30s it was terrific. People weren't as intelligent or articulate, and it was a form of frustration.
Well,
but today it seems to me the more intelligent people get, this muscle flexing doesn't...
I can see there are certain areas of federal government, for an example, where, in fact, there have been very, very few strikes because there is collective bargaining and there is a creative effort. But now, for an example, in a great number of our cities, your municipal workers in various categories do not benefit at all at the same level that comparable workers in the private sector. All across the South, and Southwest and Southeast as an illustration, all kinds of municipal workers live on poverty wages.
Yeah, I know.
This is true in Memphis yet.
Well, that's where...
workers, public, you know...
If you'll excuse me, Lawson, that's where those Memphis workers... I wondered why the National Union was not down there with those men.
Well, the National Union wasn't here with us.
It wasn't?
That's how we managed to fight the battle effectively. But the point is, these men themselves still made the decision that the only way they could begin to get the city government to even listen to them was when they walked off on strike. In this area of municipal employment, in particularly, you have vast poverty areas and you have vast injustices being perpetrated against poor people, and many of them are black people.
I know.
Here's where I say, at least, you see, that the strike as an instrument to create change for them
wasn't very necessary.
Well, Reverend Lawson, was not one of the prominent aspects of the strike the fact that there was no recognition of the union there?
Absolutely none. And in fact, the city government had taken an injunction against the union and an injunction against, you know, any kind of a strike.
All right, now, but what happens in an area where there is a recognized union?
Mm-hmm.
How do you equate that?
Yeah. Here again, I would say that even in that case where you have a recognized union, that union has to have power. And its power is not only in the number of members it has, but its power is also in its ability to, control the working processes of that department or of that
factory. Weren't they part of the SCME, the State, County, Municipal Workers?
Yes.
Yes, well, that's a very powerful union. Right up here, they had just had a strike, a sanitation strike up here, and won a terrific bargain. I mean, I wondered why there wasn't more... why they weren't down there in the midst of that strike.
Well, they were. Ask me. I mean, this is an ask me union. They were here. But you see, and in fact, they brought great skills of bargaining. But you fail to understand that in the case of Memphis, and also Mobile, Alabama, and Baltimore, and a number of other cities across the South, city government absolutely refused to even sit down and negotiate meaningfully. This was the problem.
Well,
because, simply because they said, look, you know, we don't recognize a union, and no public employees can strike. That's all of it. So we don't have to sit down with you, even though these men in the strike, in both strikes in Memphis, in fact, this year, even though these people had worked very hard to get themselves together in their own organization.
Couldn't that have been settled by national labor relations?
It could have been settled by national legislation. For an example, I am somewhat at least in favor of somehow including public employers within the same context as private employers. In other words, we do have a kind of dual morality here.
Well, I don't know. Private employees, you see, I mean, being a civil service worker, I'm a worker, and I mean, a union, but that isn't just the same, I don't think it's equated, because a private, in private employment, a man can be discharged, if work gets slow, he can be laid off. A civil service worker, at least in New York, he doesn't get laid off. I mean, there's so many more. I'm not saying that that the city is all right, and the many times when it had to bargain and work. But I can remember when many gains were made, not through going out taking to the streets. But
Do you feel that a civil service employee has more advantages?
Yes.
And because of this, he should not strike?
Because of his security, he can still bargain. And especially in the fields where it affects the people, in hospitals and in welfare and even transportation where people are affected, you can work. You can continue to work while I feel that if the union heads are worth their salt, then they could still be bargaining.
Well, Reverend Lawson, do we see a difference in the definition of what a government worker is?
No, I don't. You see, you're accepting a difference in terms of the employee for a local government or a state federal government and employee in private sector, and I say that this difference is no longer that clear at all. That on the contrary, the person is still a worker, and therefore the person still has a certain rights which we have long since in the private sector recognized. Now, what has been the general pattern in the United States is that we've made the municipal employee or the public employee in many, many instances a kind of a plantation peasant or plantation slave. So, for an example, in Detroit, as an example, the hourly wage, the minimum hourly wage in the private sector was $2.04 an hour in 1955. In among government workers doing the same work, it was $1.79 an hour. You have in instances even in New York that I've seen from time to time where if a man was working for the public transport authority, he had one wage. If he was working for the private transport authority in New York, he got a better wage. Now, all I'm saying, I am not trying to say, you see, that you have to settle it through strikes. I think that most labor people would say, no, by no means, you know, we want to settle it at the bargaining table. But they also see that in the long history of America, it has been the power of people to demonstrate peacefully at certain points that has given them the power to make their collective bargaining meaningful when the employer, whether government or private, was not willing to negotiate in good faith.
Well, I wish the unions would do a little more to break down discrimination in the private sector. They would be as energetic. In well, private, I mean the philosophical.
Well, I agree.
Yes,
we have no arguments with that.
Yeah.
At all. I'm not a vast advocate.
There's a lot
of the union. I think the labor movement in the United States has generally gone asleep.
Yeah.
And has failed both in terms of trying to help deal with the problems of poverty and some of the serious economic questions of our country, and most certainly in terms of treating people fairly.
Ms. White,
I thought about that in my own mind.
Ms. White, I want to thank you very much for calling.
The government, because they couldn't get into private industry, certain amongst the black people who work in the government, because the unions aren't as energetic in
unions are terrible across the country.
Yes.
Reverend Lawson and Ms. White, thank you very much for calling, ma'am.
Thank you.
This is Night Call in New York. We return to our guest, Reverend James Lawson, calling in from Memphis, Tennessee, following station identification. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest, Reverend James Lawson, after station identification. Next week on Night Call, the problems of growing old and the tragedy of nursing homes in America. The growth and changes in the Black Liberation Movement, not only in America but around the world. An internationally known columnist on what's happening in Washington. A trial lawyer for dissenters, Rap Brown, Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and Yippie Jerry Rubin. And the problems of the poor in America's most depressed and isolated area, Appalachia. Monday, Richard Garvin, critic of America's treatment of old people, who says the filth of old people's homes is worse than any slum. Tuesday, James Foreman, chairman of the International Affairs Committee of SNCC. Wednesday, Drew Pearson, Washington columnist on what's happening on Capitol Hill. Thursday, trial lawyer William Kunstler, attorney for the dissent. And Friday, Harry Cowdell, author of Night Comes to the Cumberlands on the squalor, ignorance, and poverty of Appalachia. All this next week on Night Call. Ask your own questions direct. Speak for yourself collect from anywhere in North America to guest Reverend James Lawson, a leader of the Memphis garbage strike, about the problems and rights of public service workers. Call Night Call collect from the East and Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. From the West on area code 212-749-4300. And from the New York area on 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
And we'll take our next call from Indianapolis, Indiana. Mr. Wood is hearing Night Call of WFBN. Mr. Wood?
Hello.
Good evening, sir.
I'm talking to the Reverend Mr. Lawson, is that right?
Yes, sir.
What? Hello, Mr. Lawson.
Yes.
I, too, am a minister in religion, and I recognize the fact that we live in a country, in a society, a competitive society. And this competitive society in which we live, naturally, is made up of the people of two sides, and did you ever hear the saying that goes like this, what is sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander?
Oh, yes.
Well, this is not necessarily true. I came up with the saying, people who work people make more money than people who work. And this is what we have in our world today. People working people for the sake of making more money. Is that what you think?
Well, I don't know where your question, sir, has any bearing on our subject tonight. Now, if you want to address it to the public workers or to the public service workers, then maybe we can give you an answer.
Well, this thing of striking, it is a struggle for more money, right?
Not always. In many instances, it's for grievances. For example, here again in the Memphis scene, just a year ago now, the two of the sanitation workers were moving behind a garbage truck with a hydraulic device, and they were pulled into the device. They were killed. Their families received no compensation for this. So the strike here in Memphis began when the men reported to work on a rainy day and were ordered either go to work or go home, while the white supervisors could stay in the barn and play cards and drink coffee and receive full day's pay. See? So it's not always simply money. It's also for other kinds of benefits. For example, certainly one of the things that's shaping up in some of the highly technological industries today is the whole question of the 35-hour work week.
Does that answer your question, Mr. Wood?
Well, the point I was referring to was the fact that even these benefits, it's evidence is a struggle in our society where people are trying to take advantage of other people, right?
No, I don't think so. I think that in many instances we have in our society legitimate grievances. In many, many instances, great injustice. And much of the unrest and much of the unrest in terms of labor problems are very frequently because of these legitimate grievances which are not being met.
Well, I didn't mean to infer that that your side was trying to take advantage of your employer. I'm speaking as a neutral observer.
Yeah. Well, I would say about this, you see, that in the area of public employees, except certain segments of this field, and this is the fastest growing labor field in the country, especially on a local level and a state level. In this area, I think you'll find that in many, many instances, public employees are not dealt with dignity. And as I've said earlier over the program, in the great Southeast and Southwest, you will find that many of these employees are black employees, and many of them are underemployed. That is, that they work hard, but they receive poverty wages,
right,
with few other benefits.
Right, I agree.
So the beginning processes of unionizing that's going on among these people is fundamentally an effort on their part to try to share in the shaping of their destiny, in the shaping of that job.
Right.
So that it can become a job of dignity for them.
Mr. Wood, I want to thank you for calling, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. This time out to Jamestown, New York, Mr. Apperson is hearing Night Call over WKSM. Mr. Apperson?
Mr. Law.
Good evening, sir.
Good evening. I think public employees, when they even take a job, give up a lot of rights. For instance, we're dictated to, you know, about how many hours we can work outside of our job. We also lose the right to run for public office, at least here, you know. And now we don't even have a right to go on strike like a factory employee. So I don't see any other way that we can get our benefits without the strike.
Well, sir, if you gave up so much, why would you go into public service work?
Well, you like it to begin with.
Yeah.
But you don't realize, I think a guy 21 years old doesn't really realize what he's giving up, you know, to go into in the first place.
But he's not forced to stay.
You know,
no, you could always quit.
I mean, I wonder if he has a calling to that job. I wonder if a man feels that this is most what he wants to do, to be a policeman or to work in a hospital, in a municipal hospital that works with the indigent. You know, or if a person feels that they want to be engaged in the highway department, this is where they want to work.
Well, with each...
Now, it seems to me what we do oftentimes is we say public servant, therefore that means this person ought to serve without having the same kinds of desires for participation in American affluence and dignity as the guy who chooses to work on a production line or chooses to work as a teller in a bank.
Well, then, do we need a new definition for the public servant or for the civil servant?
Yeah, I think what we need to do is to eliminate the idea that if a woman is a clerk in City Hall, that should mean something fundamentally different in terms of her basic rights as if she chooses to be a clerk in an insurance company. I think we ought to say that a worker is a worker and that they're due certain fundamental dignities and rights, period.
And eliminate
therefore,
the
government, which is supposed to represent justice under the law, should be paying the same wages to its employees as the private sector is obligated to pay. It should be recognizing the same processes of collective bargaining as the private sector is obligated by law to observe. And I think this would help to reduce much of the chaos that is going on in this area of the public employer and employee.
So you're calling for a complete new structuring,
yeah,
or restructuring?
I'm calling for, let's say, the elimination of the kind of double standard
that is being applied to the government workers today.
The government requires certain standards from the private employer, but if the employer is the city government of Memphis, then that employer does not have to follow the same standards of fairness.
Well, are you also asking for the same thing from the unions who constantly tell us about brotherhood and the attempt to help the downfallen and the attempt to give the worker more respect?
Definitely. I think at the same time, of course, that the unions must get themselves revamped and become more responsive to the genuine needs of people in this country. I think that too many unions have sort of today sit back at their haunches, and as long as they can get a little bit of benefit for their own employees, their own members rather, they're prepared to shut out the people, and they're prepared not to engage in some kind of creative dialogue for the benefit of improvement, of justice in our society. Other unions, of course, very blatantly shut blacks out.
Well, Reverend Lawson, do I not see the possibility of some danger signs? According to figures that I have from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, in 1968, the total workforce of employees in civil service, including federal and state, was something like 77,447,000.
77 million?
Right.
No, that's too high. Civil service?
I'm sorry, excuse me, 12,375,000. Got my figures crossed.
In civil service?
Right. In 1968. Now, if all of these employees were to become union, would we not face the...
I don't know about that figure, because is that figure the total labor force in public employment, or is that figure the force in civil service? You see, there is a difference, because many public employees are in civil service, particularly in the federal government, but in state government that makes up in state and local government that makes up the bulk that hires the greatest number of your public employees, most of these employees are not in civil service.
Well, the figures that I have from the charts I have, it says strikes by public employees and employees in civil service, and it goes back to the year 1940 up through the year 1968.
Right. Strikes by public employees and employees in civil
right,
service.
Right, so it says total government employees.
Yeah.
All right. Now,
yes, that force is between 12 and 15 million, I understand.
Right. Now, let us assume that all of these employees would become union. Would we not be faced with a situation of a total nationwide strikes at some time or other?
Well, that might be very possible. This is why all the more reason why I would urge, you see, that we try to get collective bargaining as the recognizable kind of process that will deal fairly with just grievances. At this stage of the game, in this great area, we're simply not doing that yet. There's been fair change on the part of the federal government, but as I say, in terms of state and local governments, no.
Well, in New York, we have the Taylor Law that has been consistently ignored by the unions. What happens here?
Now, I'm not acquainted with that law. I assume it's a no-strike law.
Well, it is a law that says that collective bargaining can come about and both sides can discuss their problems, and there's a system where they can continue to talk and arbitrate. And if a union doesn't like the fact finders or the proposals, they can also complain to it to the budget-making authorities in the city council. And so there is a process set up whereby the grievances, as we are discussing, can be resolved. But here in New York, the unions have decided to completely ignore the Taylor Law.
Well, I as I recall from some of my casual reading, there are some other cities or states, too, where there's a kind of a collective bargaining office that unions increasingly ignore. And I'm not sure of all the consequences of this. Certainly, I think that New York represents, in a way, where most urban life in America is going. Unless, of course, in many instances, we begin to get a vastly more enlightened role of, you know, view of the role of city government.
And unless
we also can begin to get a larger share of the tax spendings on the part of state and national government into local government. I think that the New York problem is not simply a question caused by unions. I think it's a question caused by the whole urban crisis.
But the unions also making a contribution.
Yeah, the unions, the unions may make their contribution, but at the same time, our failure... I would still say again, you see, our failure to deal fairly in the whole area of our compensation for policemen also is a great part of the issue. We constantly talk in America about support your law enforcement, but this does not mean that we are prepared to see to it that you can attract into the police force the kind of men who can really deal with law enforcement in the 20th century in America.
Reverend Lawson, I'm going to ask you to hold. Mr. Apperson, thank you so much for calling, sir. Thank you. This is Night Call in New York. Stay tuned for station identification.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Reverend James Lawson after station identification. Tomorrow night on Night Call, is religion big business? The National Council of Churches of Christ says American parishes gather in about $5 billion a year. Religious organizations have visible assets greater than Standard Oil, AT&T, and U.S. Steel combined. In Los Angeles, the Temple Baptist Church owns Philharmonic Hall. The Knights of Columbus own the land under Yankee Stadium. And because of a little-known tax law, religious groups are exempt from federal income tax on unrelated business income. Should the church be tax-free? How has the church become so rich? And what has this emphasis on money done to American religion? Tomorrow night's guest has made a thorough study of this problem. Alfred Balk, feature writer for the Saturday Review and author of a new book called The Religion Business, on Night Call. Ask your own questions direct. Speak for yourself collect from anywhere in North America to guest Reverend James Lawson, a leader of the Memphis garbage strike, about the problems and rights of public service workers. All Night Call collect from the East and Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. From the West on area code 212-749-4300. And from the New York area on 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
We'll take our next call from Twin Falls, Idaho. Mr. Pine is hearing Night Call over KTFI. Mr. Pine?
Yes. I believe the problem the public service workers are having is the same problem that all of the workers that are striking are having. And it's a problem of human nature that the more a man has, the more he wants.
Are you a student, Mr. Pine?
Yes.
How old are you?
15.
How old?
15.
Well, I don't think this is really a fair kind of statement to make, because at this time in the United States, we rarely criticize those big businessmen who often make millions of dollars, and we're not always sure if fairly. For an example, you take the many contracts with the military. We call upon our young men to go to places like Vietnam to fight for little or nothing. Many of the contractors who supply them with equipment make pretty good profits, and we don't criticize them for making those profits, even though I at least question the morality of such profit making. Now, I think we ought to see that in the United States you do have over 50 million people who live in poverty. A fair number of these people are employed. They are employed in homes. They're employed in service jobs. They're employed in municipal governments, state governments. But they still make poverty wages so that their families do not even have an income of $3,000 a year. Now, the point I would make is that much of the unrest in the labor areas here is primarily because, first of all, because we still treat too many people quite cruelly, unjustly, so that when I talk about a problem from the stance of living here in Memphis and operating with it here, I'm talking about the right of people to work and then to have some sense of dignity and decency from their jobs.
Mr. Pine, why did you pose this question that you think it was just a matter of human nature? What makes you think that?
Well, goes into the involving of the inflation problem. One person starts out wanting more money. When they get it, somebody else has to get more to equalize it. And it's just a vicious circle.
Well, how do you propose that it should be changed?
Well, there isn't much of a way to change it now. The only way that it could be changed is by a depression hitting.
Well, of course, little friend, I'm not sure
let's hope that's not the answer.
Primary reason of inflation.
Well, that's what it's getting to, is the depression.
Other factors in there. What you're saying is that chiefly labor people keep throwing the cost of living up by wanting more wages, and I've heard people say that. But I think that you can also show that in America in the year 1968, profits were at an all-time high. I think the need for profits on the part of American business is also a major factor in inflation. That the profit margin must increase. You see, I think this is also even more true.
Mr. Pine, I want to thank you for calling, sir. And good luck to you. Thank you. We have time to take another call, this time from Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. Mr. Stern is hearing Night Call over WBAX. Mr. Stern?
Good evening, Dale.
Good evening. How are you feeling?
Oh, pretty good this evening. I've been listening to your show for quite some time, and this is the first time I've been prompted to call. Reverend Lawson, let me ask you this. Does your feelings on this public employee idea of striking, if necessary, for higher wages also concern itself with teachers? has had problems in the past with a teacher's strike. The state of Pennsylvania has a what they call a public employees law of 1947, which prohibits public employees, those paid by either city, state, or federal, from striking.
Mm-hmm.
And there is currently a lawsuit. They struck for higher wages back in the early part of the summer, just before the current session. And they struck for higher wages for a $900 increase. The $900 was put in escrow account. There is now pending a lawsuit by a citizen and his lawyer against these teachers. They still have not gotten their increase. But doesn't this, when there is a law such as this, does not this border on anarchy?
Well, I think the law is anarchy. I think that's a whole part of the problem. You see, I think the governments, I think the legislatures and city councils and all do not have the right to pass laws that deprive people of certain of their rights. And of course, the school teacher is another one of the vast areas in American scene where we've been blatantly dishonest. We expect the school teacher to be able to teach and to manage and all of these things, but then we absolutely refuse to give them any kind of wages that can require of them the highest kind of service and work.
Let me ask you this. What about the merit system?
What we see now, I think, is a period of great unrest on the part of teachers, and I suspect we will see the teacher strikes even with such laws in practice. I suspect we'll see such strikes increase simply because we will not stop and make a strong effort to deal with their legitimate grievances and needs.
Well, Reverend Lawson, if this is as you feel, that the law itself is anarchy,
yes.
It is still the law. No matter how we feel about the law itself, it is still the law.
Well, I have to disagree with that in a democracy. I think that
Mr. Stern and Reverend Lawson, we're getting ready to get involved, and I'm sorry we don't have enough time. Thank you very much for calling, sir.
Okay.
Thank you. Reverend Lawson, I want to thank you so very much for being our guest tonight on Night Call. And I'm only hoping that more of the people who are involved in the unions and union presidents will adopt the humane attitude that you have. Thank you for being with us. This is Del Shields in New York. Good night and peace.
Night Call, the first and only nationwide listener call-in show on vital issues. Tomorrow night, same time, same station. The churches should be taxed like the rest of big business, says Alfred Bock, writer and social critic. Listen tomorrow night. Discuss freely and responsibly your own personal opinions. Speak for yourself on Night Call. Produced by the United Methodist Church, presented with National Council of Churches, National Catholic Office for Radio and Television, American Jewish Committee, and Urban Coalition.